this seasonal special of the Chiefs, whether sorting through the racks at Le Bon Marché in Paris or pottering around the stores of Seyfeld, we know our listeners will have what makes for a satisfying retail experience fresh in their minds. To look ahead to bricks and mortar's future, we cross the Atlantic to Florida to meet Matthew Whitman Lazenby, CEO of the iconic family-run luxury retail complex, Miami's Bal Harbour Shops. In our conversation, we take a look at why Bal Harbour's numbers are reaching historic highs and why the renowned intimate approach to design and layout of their space won't be forgotten as they look towards a major expansion. Plus, how to maintain the all-important emotional connection to the customer, and we find out which tenants are at the top of Lazenby's Christmas wish list. I'm Tyler Brulé in Zurich, and this is The Chiefs on Monocle 24. Matthew, thanks very much for joining us. Maybe it would be great to kick off. Give us a little bit of a snapshot. The scene in Bal Harbour right now, we're just in the run-up to the Christmas period. We're just really in the midst, off the back of Art Basel. How do things look at the moment?
This period of time, of course, in the retail world is crunch time. So coming off of a global pandemic, as we are, Art Basel last year being canceled, there is a lot of pent-up demand, and it is fair to say that people are back with a vengeance. We tend to track vehicle traffic with the most reliable data. That's been up double digits really all year long. That's astounding, I think, for anyone, but considering that we're under construction, we have a number of parking spaces that have gone offline because of that. We were really budgeting for flat to falling levels, and I'm thrilled to say that we got that wrong.
What do you put that down to? On one side, you could, of course, go and look at the overall Florida approach. You have become a bit of a global poster child, both good and bad. I mean, the spotlight has been on Florida for reasons of being, completely hedonistic and a bit crazy. And on the other side, people celebrating it, saying, well, this is a state which has taken a very pragmatic point of view as well. It's been pro-business. It's taken a view to be open, to let people make their own decisions, and whether they want to stay indoors or whether they want to go and shop, that's their business. But what do you put that demand to that you're experiencing right now?
Politics aside, there's no doubt about it that the governor of the state of Florida has been extremely pro-business, and it's hard to be a business leader and not appreciate that he has been. There have been governors in other states that have been decidedly less pro-business, and there are consequences with those decisions. As you mentioned, you can argue there are good consequences and there are bad consequences, but I clearly do not believe that we would be enjoying the resurgence that we are enjoying. And to put some numbers to it, we get sales reported to us on a sort of a trailing 3 week after the month closes basis. So we just got yesterday October sales. We were up 68%. In the month of October, and we're up about 63% over a rolling 12-month basis. And those numbers are staggering. And in my 20 years with my family, we've never seen anything like that. These are truly record-breaking months. And in fact, the last 18 months have been the best 18 months in our nearly 60-year history. It's really unprecedented.
Maybe we can come back to some of the mechanics of that, because, of course, you have quite a unique setup. For those who have maybe heard of Bal Harbour and have maybe seen your advertising magazines or have maybe gone to take a peek online, it's something quite remarkable that was created. And actually, why don't we take this opportunity now? Paint another picture for us. Describe to us from a retail, from an architectural perspective, what was created back on your little stretch of Florida that made you such a global calling card then and also now?
So that's a great question. We're very proud to be in our fifth generation of family ownership. The first generation was not involved in the management, and the fifth generation is too young to be involved in management. So there have been only three generations of family managers. But that family aspect, that unrelenting focus on the long term, is clearly a huge part of our DNA, and I believe humbly a very large part of our success. My grandfather's vision was always to make an emotional connection with his customer, and he was very patient but profoundly purposeful about doing that. The idyllic sort of shopping in a garden, we broke every rule. Sight lines are obstructed all over the place in terms of being able to see from one side of the center to the other. But what we created was a was a place that matters to people. I often use this example because it sort of speaks volumes. In my 20 years now, I've been approached now about 9 or 10 times by people who have asked me if we would permit Bal Harbour Shops to be their final resting place. And of course, the answer to that is no, that's disgusting. The idea that you would touch someone at that level where they really ask you, you know, can I scatter my ashes in your koi ponds? I mean, we've done something right.
Well, I was going to say, and you probably don't know. I mean, you know, listen, when security has their eyes turned, all kinds of things could have happened anyway, right? But you know, that's another topic. The amazing things, you know, you touch on sort of sight lines, you broke all the rules. There's also a scale of intimacy that also exists there. And of course, you know, we know that, you know, I'm talking to someone in a country which, you know, which has kind of become the global benchmark for just make it as big as possible. And there's an endless amount of square feet available. But do you think part of the success, though, has been this wonderful scale that you have at Bal Harbour?
It has been, and to be very honest, it's both virtue and vice. I would argue it's more of the former. There's a human scale to Bal Harbour Shops that makes people feel not only comfortable but safe. I think that does lend, or I should say, amplify that emotional connection to which I was referring earlier. But the vice is that, you know, as you're describing, particularly coming out of COVID, where all of these sort of trends were rapidly accelerated. We see these luxury stores that are creating these temples that celebrate their brand heritage and that really speak to their customer in a way that you really can only do in a physically built environment. That's becoming more important than it ever was. There is clearly a luxury associated with space. And so how we sort of marry that need for these stores to create that, you know, that flagship environment for their valued customer and for our valued customer, but in a set of buildings that are designed with the human scale in mind, there's something of a tug of war there that we try to balance as artfully as we can every day.
Give me your impression of where, and I know this is a big question as well, but where the shopping center, you know, call it a mall if we will, where it's heading, because I just came back from Seoul. I visited the Hyundai, so, you know, it's Hyundai's new flagship department store. Now, they call it a department store, but in many ways, it almost feels like a mall because it, you know, it has the name of one brand, of course, over top the door. And yet you go in across, you know, 7+ floors, you have boutique after boutique after boutique. And there's not a lot of mixing of new brands in the way that a department store used to be, this real melange of different things happening, at least with very good department stores. But it wasn't this environment where everyone had their own defined design language. Does it cause conflict? Is it difficult today running, you know, a center like you have when you've got anchor department stores also trying to figure out their way in the world, as much as you being a landowner and a manager also trying to forge your own way in retail as well?
This has been a slow and steady shift that you have aptly described. My grandfather was Stanley Whitman. He was somewhere between a really good acquaintance and a not so close friend of Stanley Marcus, of course, the visionary merchant behind Neiman Marcus. The days of a department store being run by a shopkeeper, by someone who was focused on the merchandise and on connecting with customers and on creating this assortment of departments that were catered, certainly in the mission of the store, but also to be responsive to the community that they serviced. I'm going to say something controversial, but those days are over. Department stores, as you've just described them, are no longer a building in which there are departments that are sort of curated by merchants. They're buildings that now have leased out this corner to that tenant and that corner to that tenant, and they really are mini malls. And that is it happened slowly and then it happened suddenly. That's a fundamental shift in the way that retail centers in this country operate. Because now all of a sudden, whereas in my grandfather's day, the idea was that you would bring in these very large stores who would, you know, quote, anchor, unquote, your center. And the landlords and the department stores were partners. The department stores supplied all these people who came in droves to shop their wares. And that benefited the shopping center developer because his smaller stores now benefited from the draw of these department store anchors. But now, really, what you have are little mini competitors. So it really has drastically changed at least the American mold for shopping centers.
You have a big expansion underway at the moment, and I want to touch on that in a second. But let's go back to the role of the department store, as you said. And I think it is a problem. I was talking to one of your big tenants, or big-ish tenants, but certainly a globally important one from France. And we had this really interesting conversation about the death of the buyer, the death of curation. And they were really sort of bemoaning the fact that really good buyers are almost gone now. And I know probably a lot of listeners, you know, are probably thinking, no, well, that is my job. But it was just interesting listening to this, you know, major global, you know, French-based fashion player saying, we need department stores and we need good independent retailers, because otherwise there's no sense of discovery. Everyone can do, of course. Yeah, I mean, everyone can be direct to consumer, and that's one thing. But there is still something that happens when you walk into a physical environment that something catches your eye. There's a serendipity that simply doesn't occur online yet. Does it concern you, when fashion is so important as a key part of your lineup, that you're able to still deliver that sense of surprise and discovery?
In a word, yes. Barneys New York was intended to be the third anchor of our expansion in this country. It's hard to think of a better historic example of that buyer who understood the importance of capturing emerging brands during their ascendancy and introducing a customer that wasn't yet familiar with them to them at an early stage, so that they could become early adopters. And I agree. And you know, you mentioned it's a globally relevant and powerful French fashion brand. That doesn't narrow it down very much. But whoever said that, it is absolutely right. And it is a concern. And we see, you know, we have a store in Bell Harbor Shops called The Webster. Now, that is a store led by an incredibly talented merchant. And so stores like that, in my humble view, have started to recognize that there's clearly a void, and therefore there's clearly an opportunity. And as the Webster has started to roll out in more and more markets, they and others like them are, I believe, stepping up and doing their best to fill that void. But if it isn't filled, it clearly will create a problem, if not today, certainly for tomorrow.
Let's focus on the expansion. So when I hear this, it panics me, because I would say, you know, when I land, in the U.S. Southeast, I always want to go and check out Bal Harbour. And I come back to, I wasn't just, you know, reading off any notes. I've walked your development many times, and it is this intimacy and this scale. And to be very frank, it's concerning an expansion, because you know we're at a time right now when even in good places, you know, leasing periods and just getting out to get the right shingles above the door is difficult. So I don't know. Put me at ease. Tell me about this expansion and why it's going to be good for Bal Harbour, and of course for your customers.
I appreciate that you're concerned, because when my family and I sat down, my grandfather, of course, was still alive in those days. We grappled too over being extremely protective of and maintaining that intimate human scale. But as we've discussed today already, recognizing that you need to be responsive to the needs of your customers, and our first layer customers are our tenants, and then their customers are also our second line customers. And what we were hearing was availability of space was insufficient for their needs. And frankly, so insufficient was it for their needs that they voted with their feet and started opening stores in other parts of town where they hadn't previously opened stores, because they had essentially limitless opportunity for space. Again, it's helpful to use data. The nearest shopping center to us is north of us in the town of Aventura. That shopping center is over 2 million square feet. Bal Harbour Shops today is around 450,000 square feet. And when we expand, it'll be a little over 600,000 square feet. So the scale is still very small, considering that its focus is so narrowly on the luxury end of the retail spectrum. And we went to great lengths and arm wrestled with a number of architects who all understandably want to make their mark and want the new part of the shopping center to feel like it was born in 2022 and not 1965. But we think that the the fabric of the existing center, its scale, the way that it frankly celebrates the stores themselves and lets the built world kind of disappear behind all that magic, that creates the compelling destination that we think resonates with people on an emotional scale. And so when we're done, we hope that someone who's never been to Bal Harbour Shops before can't tell where the expansion began and the old part ends, because it really should feel, all of it should feel like home.
You've addressed sort of maybe one of my architectural concerns, because as I said, I think what was created going back to the mid-60s, was quite remarkable. So if that level of respect is going to be there, then that sounds like fantastic news. Let's look over the horizon, over, let's say, the blueprints and the plans for this. So we've seen a number of different things, of course, happening within retail spaces all over the world. There was such a crazy shift towards being so luxury and so fashion focused that, again, some more forward looking department stores and also large scale developers as well, started thinking, well, what happened to the food hall? What happened to actually, you might want to go out and buy a jacket from Chanel, but also you might want to cook dinner at the same time as well. So we've seen food coming back in, and not just food to eat in place, but also, this whole notion of really elevated food markets, etc. Does this play into that as well? Because you talk about that sense of community. You are really, you are a community anchor for your stretch of the coast that you're on. And in many ways, you're a global destination. What is that friction going to be like? Because I think one thing we have certainly learned from this pandemic is that, we can't rely on, just like you couldn't, forever rely on Brazilian tourists who are great for you once upon a time, where are they today? The same thing has happened elsewhere in the world where people think, we can't rely on the Chinese. We have to rely on our home market. We have to be able to think about people who live 20 streets away. They're core to us. So what is that balance going to look like as you move towards this expansion?
We hear from our retailers all the time about this renewed focus on appealing to and really valuing that loyal local customer who, as you aptly described, should come back again and again and again, and is less dependent upon sort of the many moving parts in a global world, particularly now that we're all aware of what can happen when when pandemics strike. You also mentioned, though, the importance of something like a restaurant. And our food and beverage offering has been fundamental to our success since 1965, when we opened with what was then, one of the best restaurants in America called Schraff's. And it occupied probably around 15, maybe even as much as 20% of the shopping center at that time. We opened as a one-level shopping center, no Neiman, no Saks. And so the evolution of the F&B offering has been something that we have been careful to curate. And over the past 12 months, our restaurant category has generated about $55 million in sales. And the turning point probably happened around 15 or so years ago, whereas, you used to bring in restaurants sort of as a loss leader. They didn't pay a lot of rent. They might not generate a whole lot of business, but they brought people hopefully for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, who then would, bleed off and hopefully buy that suit or buy that handbag. But now what we're seeing is that the restaurants in and of themselves are generating sales and business that is every bit as strong as the other categories. And whether that's men's and women's apparel or jewelry or shoes, they're a very critical component. And part of the reason why they are so successful, and part of the reason why gone are the days where tenants said, please don't put me next to the restaurant because I don't want my merchandise to smell like fish. Instead, the first spaces that are leased in our expansion, for example, are the ones that are nearest to restaurants. Because part of that is because those restaurants of all of our tenants are the ones that are most focused on and most catering towards that local customer, because that customer, they can rely on them week after week and not just sort of seasonally, as is the case with a more tourist focus.
Just before we go, Matthew, maybe again, now let's look beyond the blueprints, but surveying the broader U.S. retail landscape, of course, we have been through, well, almost 2 years now of hearing that on one side, we've had all these accelerating forces that of course, you made for delirious fortunes for lots of course, online retailers. And we know how good it's been for many. But at the same time, a lot of people are also, I would say, maybe retracting the words as well and saying, well, isn't it amazing what happened when the doors flew open again and people could move around and do so in the way that they were accustomed to? The bounce back, as you've also cited with Bal Harbour, has been extraordinary. So what is the retail landscape going to look like? Do you think the shakeout is done? Are we finished with all of the department stores either being in Chapter 11 or going bankrupt? Do we see a sense of rebuild going on right now? And I guess where it's probably second part of the question is, you know, the U.S., we've really seen a hollowing out of the middle. So many department stores and so many retailers that occupy the middle gone. And there's been a focus on low end. And then, of course, the territory that you're in being really at the pinnacle of luxury, great service and a wonderfully built environment. But how does it look for you going ahead?
We had under development somewhat on the back burner a project called the Bal Harbour Shops Marketplace that we were working on sort of slowly but surely when the pandemic struck almost 2 years ago. And we accelerated that project, and we actually launched the Bal Harbour Shops Marketplace softly about 5 months ago. And it endeavors to present to the world a digital experience that is akin to the physical Bal Harbour Shops experience. We're still onboarding tenants. We have roughly sort of a dozen that are participating now. And what we see it as is simply an amenity. Customers like my parents, for example, who were in their 70s, didn't purchase, buying things from, you know, off of their computer screen, but seemed very foreign to them prior to 2 years ago. Now my mother knows how to, you know, she knows how to go to her computer or her device and, you know, buy milk and have it sent to her, ironically, in much the same way that her mother would have had milk sent to her a long time ago. We don't believe that people have been talking about the end of shopping centers since as long as I've been alive. And certainly there have been a number of shopping centers. There have been a number of retailers who have frankly gone extinct. I don't believe that there's a significant number of those that were pushed out of business because of COVID. I think that there were those that were already teetering and COVID just sort of pushed them over the edge. So the resurgence to the bricks and mortar world, particularly in the luxury end of the spectrum and in the value end of the spectrum, it shouldn't surprise anyone. But I don't know whether the fallout, particularly with department stores, is done, because as we discussed earlier, that's a model that has really turned around 180 degrees. And if they can figure out a way to remain as relevant to their customers in this new world where they're sort of full of leased concessions, and they can still speak to that customer with a message that's consistent and that's clear, then they'll survive. But, you know, if you had asked my mother or my grandmother, are you a Neiman Marcus or a Saks customer, not only could they have answered that question instantly, but then they could have spent a long time telling you why. But if you ask my wife that question, she doesn't know how to answer that question. She says, well, you know, if I'm looking for this product and I can find it easier at that store or that store or at a better cost, I'll shop there. She has no loyalty to those brands the way that my mother or my grandmother did. And if they don't fix that problem, it won't be good.
Just last question, but before we go, it's we're in the Christmas season right now. If you had a Santa's sort of wish list for retail, if you could think of one, two, or three types of tenants you're looking for when you sort of walk around and you walk the concourses of Bal Harbour and you think, God, I wish we had this type of store. What do you think's missing?
Well, we're spoiled. I'm the first to admit it. In our 57th year, we are very pleased to have been able to provide to our valued customer just about every store that they want and that we've been asked to bring in. What we hear the most requests for really is for continued variety in F&B offerings. So we are spending a lot of our time doing that. As I mentioned, the restaurants that we have are very strong. But we have Italian, we have French, we have Japanese, we have American, but there's a whole lot of cuisines that I didn't just mention. And so probably the top three on that list are all different restaurants that we intend to bring in. Some will open immediately, as in next year, and others will have to wait until we open our expansion a few years down the road.
My thanks to the CEO of Miami's Bal Harbour Shops, Matthew Whitman Lazenby, for this week's episode of The Chiefs. Join us next time where we turn to the world of security and look ahead to Europe's changing threat landscape in 2022. This episode of The Chiefs was produced by Paige Reynolds and edited by Steph Chungu with the recording assistance of Desiree Bandley. I'm Tyler Brulé. Thank you very much for listening.